Just a couple of days ago, I had the opportunity to finish reading a book called Scent of the Missing, Love and Partnership with a Search and Rescue Dog. It's written, the book is written by Susanna Charlson. Excuse me. And I guess I thought in this day and age with GPS and everything else, do we really need a lot of search and rescue dogs out there? And what I found out pretty quickly was that, yes, in fact, we do need search and rescue dogs that will find missing persons. And any given day in America, here's a fact that I found from reading Susanna's book. In any given day, there are as many as 100,000 active missing person cases. Any day, 100,000 of them. And a large percentage of these cases, unfortunately, go unresolved. And at the same time, the recovered and identified remains of something like 40,000 people are held by medical examiners across the country. Yeah, that's like the population of a medium-sized city. It's just an absolutely amazing figure to me. Well, Susanna Charlson is one of the really good people who devotes a lot of her time and energy. And as with many, many other hundreds and hundreds of volunteers, to work with dogs, train dogs to be able to find people through scent. And then she might be getting up in the 2 o'clock in the morning out of bed to take her dog, Puzzle, somewhere, and might be gone for all night, maybe one day, maybe 2 days. It might go a long time without even any sleep. And she does this because she has a public service gene in her, I think. And so I was, after reading the book, I thought, boy, it's an amazing, amazing amount of giving that goes on for these folks. And I'm so glad that Susanna had the time and the energy to write the book, because it really gives you a great insight into what goes into the training of these dogs, both for the trainer and the trainee, the person doing the training and the dog himself or herself. There's an amazing relationship, amazing amount of work, and amazing relationship that developed that she has done a good job of codifying in her book in a very narrative fashion that really makes for compelling reading. So I'm happy to have her with us by phone. Susanna, are you there?
I am here. Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, absolutely.
How's Puzzle?
Well, she is well. She last I saw was belly up on my bedroom floor with a toy stuffed snake dangling between her paws. So, yeah, she's fine. She's semi-conscious and enjoying every minute of it.
Well, we may get to a snake story a little bit later on as we talk, because you tell one or two good ones in your book. But I want to give people a chance to join in. So if you have a question or a comment or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. As I was saying to begin the show, many as 100,000 active missing person cases on any given day, there's certainly a huge need for people like you and dogs like Puzzle.
That's correct. That's correct. And as many teams and handlers as there are out there, certainly we do not even begin to approach the number of active cases and cold cases that would be searched if there were resources there and leads there to continue to pursue them.
Well, what possessed you to write this book?
Well, I have been a writer for probably about 30 years, and most of my work was broadcast writing. And so I was very schooled and familiar with the short form, and wrote a lot of short form essays with an intent for radio, and specifically public radio, which is my passion. There was a point where I had an opportunity to read in front of a group of long form writers, actually novelists. And I read one of the essays as just kind of a departure. They'd been hearing fiction all day, and I thought, you know, I'll give them something different and short and real and, you know, nonfiction. And they all said, oh, this is a book. This is a book. And in various terms, you know, gestured me to the door and to the typewriter and said, you know, essentially get on this now. You know, the fact that the work resonated with them and that the concept of an insider's look into this work was something that they valued. You know, who was I to decline their advice? Off I went.
I'm glad you went off.
And
did that. It's wonderful. And I really like the book because you... you sort of start from the beginning with this dog puzzle that took a lot of – well, in the first place, you had been – I should say you had been involved in rescue work for a long time, but not necessarily with your own dog. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's correct. I actually am a flight instructor and commercial pilot, and I, for a time, was very intensely flying paid flights where – oh, sometimes we were looking for the trajectory of downed aircraft after a small aircraft accident. Sometimes I was overflying flash flood areas with ranchers and insurance adjusters and sometimes, you know, helping them negotiate how to get food to stranded livestock. I flew over, when the altitude restrictions lifted, I flew journalists and other responders, photographic responders, over both the Oklahoma City bombing site and the Koresh compound. And particularly Oklahoma City bombing site, I just remember that there was a point looking down that that I thought not every disaster needs an airplane, but they pretty much all need dogs. And about that time in the Dallas Morning News, there was a picture of a Dade County fire rescue canine handler and his beautiful golden Aspen, who had been working all night in the rubble of the Mura Federal Building. And I clipped that photo and I kept it, and when I found it in my things a few years later, for whatever reason, the timing was just right and it moved me, and I joined a canine team as a field assistant in 2001, which seems like the right moment to have done so. And certainly, you know, 2001, the new century demonstrated just all the forms of catastrophe that could befall us. And so it was the right thing to do. And I ran behind certified dogs and handlers for 3 years as a field assistant, doing the navigation and medical triage and radio communication and orientation work that's all necessary for these teams in the field. And then in 2003, I took a test that demonstrated I understood enough about canine handling to become the next potential handler, and I got Puzzle in 2004. That's the long path, yeah.
Well, it is a wonderful story, and we already have several callers online who want to visit with you, and maybe we'll take a call. Jackie and Judy online. Jackie, we'll go to you in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, good morning. You haven't mentioned yet what kind of a breed Puzzle is.
Puzzle is a golden retriever.
Okay.
She is a purebred golden retriever, a little blonde golden. And she is from a line, actually, that I carefully researched because I needed a dog that had a background that demonstrated a lot of work ethic. And so she's from a line that a mother that has agility and obedience awards, and a sire that has obedience and hunt awards, and on both sides a pretty strong hunt background. So she's the product of two lines that seem to demonstrate in the line a lot of drive.
I don't think that people realize, I'm familiar with one group in our Milwaukee area, People in Paws Search and Rescue. They have Rottweilers that can smell a dead body under the water. Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize the kind of work that goes into training these dogs. They have bloodhounds, and they are people who have full-time jobs and count a lot on volunteer, on help. You know, if people will make a contribution. But I've met two of the bloodhounds, and they're absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. I commend you for the work that you're doing. And I know it took you a while to get into it because it's a big commitment. But I appreciate that, and I'm going to get the book and read more about it. Thank you.
Right. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And she's exactly right. It's a huge time commitment. The majority of teams that I know are all volunteer, and so these people are making this life choice, and it is a life choice, often quite apart from their day jobs. And
quite a variety of people. I mean, you're a pilot, and the other people that you talk about in your book with their dogs, pretty varied types of positions that they hold.
That's correct. I mean, you do get a lot of first responders who are also just interested in working with a dog. So it's not uncommon to have firefighters and detectives and paramedics and that kind of thing. But we also have a lot of retired military. And then, you know, on the other side, we've got pilots, we've got an accountant, we've got some contractors, some building contractors. We have one young woman that is aspiring to be a pastry chef. So our common condition is, you know, a compassion for the community in need and our belief in and willingness to work with the dogs.
Susanna Charlson, our guest today, her book is titled Scent of the Missing. I just finished reading it a few days ago, and I'm fascinated by it. And she'll be continuing with telling us about her experiences and training her dog Puzzle and experiences out in the field after we take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly with Susanna Charlson. Great to have you along on the IdeasNet. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking you behind the scenes with a search and rescue dog as seen through the eyes of Susanna Charlson and written about in her book, Scent of the Missing, Love and Partnership with a Search and Rescue Dog. I'm really pleased to have her with us today. I read it and really enjoyed it and learned quite a bit about the whole process of training a dog and then what the dog and the handler go through on a pretty regular basis. By the way, most of these folks, in fact, I think almost all are volunteers, or maybe are they all volunteers, Susanna?
Well, in the majority, yes. There are teams that are associated with FEMA and Homeland Security that have funds, and many of those are made up of first responders who are already paid by their municipalities. But a lot of those dogs and some of those handlers away from actual FEMA deployments are still working their dogs with volunteer teams and doing volunteer work that is unfunded. But, you know, I would say, I don't want to say all because all is dangerous, but I would say the majority of Canine SAR teams in the U.S. are made up of volunteers who, yes, get up in the middle of the night and search all night and then go to work the next day, or, you know, many of them give up vacation days, et cetera, to do this job. And because the gear and the travel is often expensive, there's a financial commitment here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Judy and Marinette's been waiting quite a while, so I want to give Judy a chance. Hi, thank you very much for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to commend so very much each and one of those handlers and trainers out there, and especially the dogs. They're risking their lives every day for these people, and no one could do without them. I commend them so much, and please, please thank Puzzle so very much for me.
I will do it. I will do it. Thank you.
Do you get that kind of response from folks pretty often?
Yes. Yes, we do. Especially the people who, you know, have stood at the edge of a lake and have watched the dogs go out on boats and those boats sweep back and forth in the, you know, in the desperate hope of finding a boating survivor, boating accident survivor, or bringing, you know, the body home of a missing swimmer. And, you know, those people are very aware, either, you know, at Lakeside or in the middle of a neighborhood where the lights are flashing all around and someone is known gone. They're very aware of the dogs and the handlers who go out and go out and go out again and are willing to go out a fifth and sixth and seventh time across days to bring somebody home.
Yeah. What is talk about the training for a dog like Puzzle. And I think it's great in your book, the fact that you talk about everything from picking Puzzle to every aspect of her training.
Well, we bring puppies into this, or young dogs into this, who typically have already passed aptitude tests. And those aptitude tests are sort of modified tests by Campbell and another one by Volhard. And they're tests that are often used for other things as well, like evaluating puppies for guide dogs or assist dogs or hunt partners or whatever. And so whether it's a pup from a planned litter or it's a young dog that has been given up to a shelter, perhaps because it was too high energy and too active and too creative at jumping over fences. Mm-hmm. These dogs are evaluated, and if they demonstrate the aptitude for search, which includes things like problem-solving ability and a good nose and tenacity and willingness to work with a human, then what happens is we bring them home, and I'll take Puzzle's case. A puppy from a planned litter, they come home and often they arrive before they've actually had their last parvo shot. So the training begins literally in the house because it's not really safe yet to put them on the ground outside and in places where parvo could still be a threat. So you start the training in the house, you know, with scent games, and they hide treats and they've got to find them and root them out. And then when the dog can actually begin paws on the ground, usually around 11 weeks, we start them with very simple searches called runaways, where the dog is turned around and someone with a treat runs away a short distance and the dog is given the command find. And usually the scent of human and the scent of treat is just right there for them, you know, very clear. Mm-hmm. And they run the short distance and they find the missing person and they get this huge reward. And from those basic runaways that, you know, fat little puppies have to master, you know, running around corners on legs that don't yet have full muscle control, then you get to harder and harder layered searches, multiple victims, multiple buildings, you know, buried in rubble and wrapped in tarps so their scent isn't escaping easily. So that the adolescent and the young adult dog is really demonstrating what he or she is willing and able to do in a condition often that is more difficult than real searches are.
And, you know, you do a great job of describing what a dog has to go through. I mean, the dog, if, let's say it's a burn area or something, you've got so many. The dog has to concentrate on that one smell, that one scent, and avoid all the distractions and all of the other competing scents. It is to me, as you described it, to me it was amazing that an animal can actually follow a scent over a long distance sometimes and be successful.
Yes, yes. And they can be commanded to simply find any human scent and ignore, you know, everything else, rotting vegetation, animals, car that needs an oil change, and just find human. Or they can be commanded, if they're scent discrimination dogs, as Puzzle is, to ignore all of those things plus every other human scent but the one scent that they're trying to match from a scent article they smelled 2 hours ago. So it is pretty amazing. The thing I think that makes it a little more approachable to us is to imagine, though, if we went into a garden and we were told to only look at the purple flowers.
Yeah.
If we've got good color vision, it would be pretty easy for us to run through the garden and go purple flower there, purple flower there,
yeah,
and ignore all the yellow, orange, green, pink, white.
And so that's what the dog is doing, just with their noses. Not to discount that it's brilliant work and that it's often difficult work when you got wind and terrain affecting all of that. But you know, because our sight, and we're so used to discriminating things by sight, I think that's the closest thing I can give to how the dogs do it with their noses, and it's instinctive to them, especially if they're, you know, breeds that are driven by nose.
Yeah. We had a caller who has a young daughter who is really interested in this whole area and wonders if this book would be right for her. I think it would, but I imagine you would too, but maybe not.
Well, there is, I'm not sure of the age of the daughter. Mm-hmm. As you know, there are some descriptions of fairly graphic death. Mm-hmm. In it,
yeah.
And that I think might be the only major factor that a parent would probably want to discuss with a child at the point of reading. But I've got a number of teenagers and preteens who are coming to the signings and buying the book, and many of them, interestingly, are planning to certify as therapy dog partners.
Oh.
So they are interested in the whole partnership aspect, and in many cases, their relationship with their dogs has gone through some of the same stages that mine went through with Puzzle. So we are kindred spirits in that. So I know there are young people reading the book, but there is a certain kind, there's a certain emotional stamina required in some of those searches, as you know.
And, so maybe mom might want to get the book and read it herself first, and she could then be in a very good position to judge. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. I like, by the way, how you've organized the book, because it sort of goes back and forth from chapter to chapter, from sort of training information to then other kinds of searches and actual looking for folks. And I think that was a great approach. Mike Perry, by the way, is a good friend of mine. So I was glad to see you acknowledge him in your book as well.
Oh, Mike I'm a huge fan, and if I can take a moment, I'll tell you that there was a point in the process of writing this book where for about 6 weeks I just put my head down on my desk, because I had an ethic and a conscience and a compassion for these families and communities that we served, and I really wanted to write about this experience and our intersection in their lives, and yet I had a conscience about not yielding these people up to public scrutiny. So it was the issue of writing nonfiction and being compassionate and grateful and still allowing people to be anonymous, relatively anonymous. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do, And then a writer friend and a firefighter in the same week said, oh, you ought to read Mike Perry's Population 485, because he's tackled the same thing. So I went, oh, yeah, I'm going to go do that. So I bought the book, read it, and it's the only book in the history of my history as a reader, and I'm a huge reader, that I ever read and immediately started over again, because I was so loath to leave his voice. I mean, he's a powerful writer. And so not only did I enjoy the book as on a literary term, but I saw that, yes, he was able to handle that condition with grace and with power and with truth. And so it told me it can be done. And I took my head off my desk and said, it can be done. And you know, onward. What is it in Wisconsin we say, onward? Isn't that what he says in the book? So there
yes.
you go.
And it was, and you did a nice job of that. Well, tell us about your relationship with Puzzle and how it changed over time. Because when you first got Puzzle was, I guess he could, well, I don't know, he could take you or leave you in a way?
Well, I loved her because, I'd waited for her for a year, and I've been looking for her for a year, and it is in me to love a dog, and it would be difficult not to love a 10-week-old golden retriever puppy, at first sight. She was remarkably nonchalant about me. very aloof and responsive. I mean, she'd fetch for me and et cetera, but she just didn't seem that overjoyed to see me or be with me or be held by me or yada yada. What I ultimately learned was that Puzzle is very, very fieldy. She likes it best when she is working off lead and running 40 yards ahead of me into the brush and communicating back. And I think my intensity and my constant scrutiny and my wanting to hold her and be with her was not her favorite method of communication and collaboration. She's not a lap dog. She wants the affection that comes in a field when two people, or a dog and a person, come together and apart and say, well done. And when I realized that about her, suddenly things really, really turned around. And when I treated her as a partner I trusted, she came to me more. and we became very close. And now, of course, after searches and after intense training periods, but particularly after searches, we will collapse in a heap on the floor or on the couch or on my bed together, and we heal from this together. And she does so by choice. So, yeah.
The whole communication in the field with the dog struck me as being very interesting. Describe that relationship that you and how you work with a dog in the field.
Well, most, again, I won't say all, but most search dogs will work in the field off lead, and you give them the command and you send them into the wilderness or into the debris or into the, you know, empty building full of rooms ahead of you. And sometimes you can see them and sometimes you cannot. You are running as fast as you can, laden under often a 40-pound pack. And you have learned by watching and listening to them what signals they give to demonstrate that they've got no human scent at all, or suddenly a little bit of human scent from an unspecified source, or I think we're moving to the location where the human scent is coming from, to I've got human scent hot, present, and right here. And there are all these shades of behavior and vocalic and even a breathing change that tell the handler we are nowhere near human scent, or yep, we've got something. Oh, we've got something pretty close here. We've got something right here. And you have to learn to decode all of that on the run, behind the dog, in the dark. and one of the most amazing things is when you get to the point as a handler that you run a search in the dark, and I have a policy that in buildings, every fifth training search I do, fourth or fifth, I'll do flashlights out. So I make myself follow the dog in the dark so that I can hear the change in her breathing when she goes from no scent to suddenly having scent. Because she makes a sound I call chuff, and she goes chuff, chuff, chuff. And then the more pronounced that chuffing sound gets, I know that she's got it. And usually about that time, I'll start hearing her tail, if it's a live search, I'll hear her tail banging on things, because part of her alert, she loves people so much, is that she wags furiously. So I'll hear bang, 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 you know, on the debris or the office furniture or whatever.
Pat in Janesville has a question for you or a comment. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing? Wonderful program, enjoying it very much. I have two questions, actually. One, is the size of the dog important? You mentioned lap dog as if it was maybe it wasn't the best choice, but certainly they're loving, and that's probably not a prerequisite. But two, is there any organizations that you all tap into that we as the general public could donate to help in your efforts?
Good questions.
Very good question. Well, typically we do not use small dogs in search because for humane reasons we need a dog that is not going to be crushed or mauled by the environment. You know, in debris, a sliding piece of drywall, for instance, that might a big dog might be able to jump onto or sidestep or would bruise them, could easily crush a very small dog. So for humane reasons, we typically don't use small dogs in search. Also, of course, small ones in wilderness would be much harder to see.
Now, I do understand that there was a Jack Russell Terrier that certified in wilderness search only a few years back, and the way the handler decoded him was the Jack Russell could jump up so high. And so it would run through the field and go boing, boing, boing when it was on scent. And you know, a dog that couldn't make that kind of height would be a tough one to follow, but the Jack Russell could communicate, and it worked, but it was only a wilderness and an urban dog. So we typically do that for humane reasons. Also, it's the larger breeds and the hunt and the retrievers and the herders that typically have that bigger nose, big boxy muzzle, and they're often from breeds that are already using air scent work, which is head up, so that they can snag any human scent in a wide geographic area. Smaller dogs are often hunters that are hunting on the ground, like you know dachshunds or some of the beagles and that kind of thing, who are working more head down. And many canine teams use so much air scent work where the dog's head is up that they need a dog with some height, and they need a dog that is used to air scent work as opposed to ground-based, you know, trailing a mole into a hole, for instance, for a farmer.
Yeah.
As far as national organizations, there are national organizations associated both with canine search and rescue and other components of rescue. The National Association of Search and Rescue would certainly be one of them. Individually, however, most canine teams are also not-for-profits. And so what I would recommend for listeners is do an internet search of your state and then put in quotes, canine search and rescue. And you've got to put search and rescue in there. Otherwise, if you put canine rescue, you'll get groups that rescue dogs as opposed to groups that use dogs to rescue people. And both are worthy, absolutely. But if you're looking to support a canine search team, that's what you need to put in. And up will come a listing of teams that serve your state or who are exist in another state but still, you know, come across and work your state. Many of them are not-for-profits, and they could all use financial support. This work is costly, and there is never enough donation to cover the real expense of improving and upgrading safety equipment, for instance, and it's a fabulous opportunity. Additionally, a lot of teams are always looking for people who are willing to come out on a Saturday morning and hide as victims. So there are ways to interact and engage with your teams besides monetarily. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing. I hide for my team and other teams all the time. It's pretty amazing to be on the receiving end of both the experienced dogs and the ones in training and experience that happy moment of connection when they find you.
And just kind of along with that, and going back to the size of the dog, I remember in your book you one of the reasons you liked the Golden, having a Golden, was because people tend to associate good things with Golden. So when someone is found, they're not perhaps as likely to be frightened of a dog like Puzzle.
That's correct. And you know, that was based largely on our team's search history and what our typical calls were for. I have a particular compassion for searches involving children and the elderly. And I'm not unique in this, but research indicated to me that when someone is traumatized and frightened and weakened and lost, you don't have to dig very far to find that the approach of an unfamiliar dog can be absolutely terrifying. And the approach of an unfamiliar dog in the dark, even more so. So I was intentionally looking for a breed that was light in color, that had an open expression that could be seen even in the dark, that had that kind of teddy bear face. You know, they call it neoteny when the face of a dog still has some puppyish tendencies. And Goldens have that sort of soft teddy bear quality. And a breed that was inclined to wag furiously at the presence of a human. I chose Puzzle for that reason. I chose a Golden for that reason. I also, if you look at the breed standard, female Goldens are not that big a dog, and I needed to be able to work a dog that if I had to carry her or I had to lift her off debris, I could do it.
Yeah. And with that, we have to close. I'm so sorry that we have to conclude because I had so many more questions for you, Susanna, but you've written a wonderful book, And I thank you so much for being with us today and sharing some of your stories with us. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad to do so. And if people have other questions, I can certainly be found at Susanna@SusannaCharlson.com. So please encourage them to drop me an email.
Susanna Charlson.
Yes.
SusannaCharlson.com?
That's correct. It's Susanna@SusannaCharlson.com. Yep.
Thanks, Susanna.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Susanna Charlson is the author of Scent of the Missing, and I highly recommend it to you. And thank you very much for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.